one held by the U.S. The U.S. President Joe Biden hopes this will assist in renewing so-called democracy in the United States and around the world. The question many are asking is, what gives the U.S. the right to hold a democracy conference? In this edition of The Spotlight, that is one of the questions we will be asking our guests, and look at why the U.S. is not the democracy that it preaches around the world.
The United States always proclaims itself a leader for promoting democracy worldwide. In line with such mentality, the administration of President Joe Biden hosts a long-promised two-day virtual event, calling it the Summit for Democracy. The event on Thursday and Friday will be attended by over 100 countries. The White House says the gathering plans to defend democracy and human rights at home and abroad. China, which has not been included in the list of invitees, has challenged the U.S. claim of upholding democracy.
No matter how the U.S. glosses over itself, its true face of seeking hegemony under the guise of democracy has long been exposed to the world. The so-called Summit for Democracy will only go down in history as a manipulator and a saboteur of democracy.
Russia, which has also been excluded from the summit, already slammed it as a product of America's Cold War mentality and warned that it will stoke up ideological confrontation and a rift in the world. This is a stance that experts have doubled down.
I think it's a dangerous game that the U.S. is playing. They're sort of drawing a line of division in the world and creating an us-against-them environment, just as they did with the Cold War against the Soviet Union.
The inclusion of some invitees, such as Israel, has also drawn strong criticism given the atrocities the regime has committed against Palestinians in the occupied West Bank and the besieged Gaza Strip. Irrespective of the names of invitees and those that have been excluded, the U.S. military adventurism seems to be overshadowing the summit. America's invasions of Iraq and Afghanistan and its support for the Saudi-led war on Yemen, which have resulted in the loss of tens of thousands of innocent lives, challenge the U.S. claim of democracy promotion. Besides, humanitarian impacts of U.S. sanctions on countries that refuse to give in to its hegemony contradict such a claim. Ironically, the U.S. itself has a checkered record of human rights due to its racist approach toward minority groups, including African Americans. Advocates, analysts, and international observers have also cast a spotlight on voting rights in the United States ahead of the summit.
In recent times, clearly, the United States is not functioning as a democracy. It is functioning as a plutocracy. A democracy is a government of the people, by the people, for the people. A plutocracy is a government of the 1%, by the 1%, for the 1%.
A recent Harvard University poll found that over 50% of young people in the U.S. believe that the country's democracy is in trouble. With such an outlook, it remains to be seen how the U.S. wants to promote global democracy by holding a summit.
Our guest joining us for this edition of The Spotlight, we have Richard Becker, who's an anti-war activist from Answer Coalition, joining us from San Francisco. Also joining us is Frank Emspach, who's a political commentator, joining us from Madison.
The Spotlight. The Spotlight takes an in-depth look at the headlines, featuring interviews with well-known guests from diverse backgrounds to get to the bottom of the story. You can listen to The Spotlight every day on IRIB English Radio.
Okay, Frank Emspach, I'm going to start with you, and I'm going to go about what some reactions have been. This particular one saying Washington is trying to privatize the term democracy and create new dividing lines. by hosting a summit for democracy, which runs counter to the trend of today's world. This coming from Russia. Do you agree or disagree?
Well, I think the what's so amazing about this summit is it looks like it's something that could have been done 50 years ago at the beginning of the Cold War. And that is what's so disturbing here, because we need to move in a different direction where we're not polarizing the planet, particularly when it is obvious that in places like Burma or Israel that there are fundamental issues here about democracy. And that would be something to address. And based on the invitees and the content, things like that are not being addressed. Never mind the issues in this country where there are real attempts to limit voter participation.
Okay, let me come to you with this, Richard Becker, coming from Africa. Only less than one-third of countries there are invited to the Summit for Democracy, in which it has cast doubt on the true intention of the U.S. What do you think about Africa's stance?
Well, I think that this is just play-acting, this democracy summit on the part of Biden and the U.S. administration. I don't think it's going to help them very much. I think there's a lot of ridicule going on around the world. But the exclusion of so many countries, the invitation to this was entirely based upon calculations, political calculations in Washington. And about how to proceed. So the exclusion of most of the African countries, the exclusion of all of the Arab countries, I believe, except for Iraq, is really quite remarkable. And all the countries that are on the U.S. enemies list right now, you know, Iran, China, Russia, Cuba, Venezuela, North Korea, they're all excluded. So in the name of democracy, we have an exercise that is extremely undemocratic in its very structure.
So you talked about what we call West Asia. Let me ask you, Frank Emsbach, the reaction that some countries have had, where they call the so-called Summit for Democracy to be selective. They considered a political review based on American values. I'm going to underline that word American values that they use, which they say it will only instigate division and confrontation, and the U.S. democracy will do endless harm. This American values intertwined with democracy is something that the U.S. has preached, hasn't it, in respective countries?
I mean, this
why does the U.S. feel it can do that, or want to do that, really?
Well, I don't know what their plan is to want to do that, except to maybe begin to build a consensus for more aggressive action. But this has been the standard thing since World War I with BB&O, the first public relations firm, always conflating anything that the United States does with democracy. Because most people in the world want to see a democratic system. They want to have the right to speak. They want to have all these things. And they see or saw the United States as leading so in these areas. So the notion of democracy is quite popular. So anytime you want to do something, it's always good to try to, use the word in some fashion and mix it up with other things. Because one of the things about American values is that, you know, there aren't a set of American values that everybody agrees to, and in particular that the leading sectors of the society agree to. For instance, we don't have a democratic workplace in the United States. All employees, unless you have a union, are employees at will, meaning that the employer can fire them without cause, as long as it isn't for discriminatory reasons. Well, that's a pretty narrow vision of democracy, really. And so when we talk about American values, what's in the popular mind are the first 10 amendments to the Constitution. But what's in the real mind here is a much more narrow thing. And I think what's happening here is that kind of sort of exposure is becoming more and more evident to people in the world. They don't look to the United States as a leader. And I think the summit was an attempt to, or is an attempt to try to refurbish that image. It isn't going to work because the people fighting for democracy in the world, including some of the people in the Palestinians, including people in Burma, and including people in many, many places, are not invited. They're not considered to be Democrats or for democracy by the leaders of this country, and in fact, they are. And when you have that disconnect, this isn't going to work to move the United States forward in a positive direction, or anybody else for that matter.
Richard Becker, Frank Imspach talked about how democracy and this notion that the U.S. Is using is causing some divisions around the world. Let's take a look at, for example, the invitees here. What do you think about the fact that the U.S. invites Taiwan but not China?
Well, that's a really important one. That's a very, very important issue and a very important question because February 28th of 2022 will mark the 50th anniversary of the 1972 Shanghai Communique. And in the Shanghai Communique, which was part of the opening of relations between the U.S. and the People's Republic of China, and China, the People's Republic admission to the United Nations, was the agreement, the understanding expressed by the U.S. that there's one China. So now, it said in that Shanghai Communique that that people on both sides of the Taiwan Strait believed that. So there was the one China policy, and it was reinforced afterwards in a number of other communications that were made. So now you have the U.S. inviting the government of Taiwan as if it is an independent country. This is very dangerous. This is a very dangerous move in the direction of war for the U.S. to take this position. So it's, I think it's reckless, and I think it's very aggressive for the Biden administration to have invited Taiwan to this and excluded the real Chinese government, the government of the People's Republic.
One of the ones that was an eye-opener from this part of the world, Frank Imspach, when we take a look at it, is the fact that the U.S. says, consistent with the goals of the Summit for Democracy, the U.S. will use sanctions to counter serious human rights abuse and repressive acts across the world, is how they termed it. They've actually promoted the idea of sanctions, saying that other governments need to use sanctions on other countries when these types of violations, for example, in the arena of human rights, is occurring. How dangerous is that to not only promote that, but of course exercise it?
Well, it's totally counterproductive. The other day there was an election in Venezuela for local people, for the regions, and so on and so forth. And every single observer said that the level of participation was high, that the standards for meeting democratic, voting was high, that there were no problems, and that really it was pretty exemplary. And the net result was that the United States did nothing to drop its sanctions against Venezuela, which have caused tremendous hardship. So I don't think that the, in honesty, that sanctions can be very, very bad. They can hurt people. They cause people, I think, nations to become more oppressive. And because what happens is that you have a tremendous shortages and all kinds of stresses occur. And then even if the nation does what we allegedly wanted to do, it doesn't make any difference. That's what Venezuela shows. And, of course, Cuba, that's a whole other thing. But and, in fact, the net result of sanctions is to really attack the people in the country that we're supposedly supporting. And if we take a look at that with Iran or Iraq initially, or our threats with Russia, but the sanctions hurt the people. And the idea is that you cause enough disruption and the people will overthrow the government. Well, this is hardly a way to move forward.
When we take a look at this whole notion, Richard Becker, it's something that the U.S. Perhaps wants to renovate or establish again or reinvent, and more to give itself a stamp of approval, because around the world there are many who are questioning the U.S. in terms of the way it used to be or the power that it had, and within that the democracy that it promotes. When you take a look at the way that the U.S., for example, supports Israel vis-a-vis the Palestinians, the violations that take place there, the unwavering support that the U.S. has, or launching military interventions in Afghanistan, Iraq, Libya, and Syria. Do you think that this is so that the U.S. can renew its image of democracy around the world so it gains more respect?
Well, I think that's the idea of the Biden administration, but I think it's highly unlikely that that will be the outcome. I mean, there's many, many aspects to this. The United States is not really a democracy at all. There are some democratic rights that people have, which are being eroded seriously. And there are built-in aspects of the U.S. system which are highly undemocratic. For instance, I live here in the state of California, 40 million people. It has two senators. The state of Wyoming has about 500,000 people, maybe a little bit more. It has two senators. How can that be regarded as democratic? It's not. It's not democratic at all. There are big attacks that are taking place inside the United States on people's right to vote, rolling back rights that were won through the Civil Rights Movement, the Voting Rights Act, and so forth. Fundamentally, from the very beginning, the U.S. Constitution and the Bill of Rights, which encompass the rights, came from a very early period in the rise of capitalism in the world, and include no economic or social rights, only political rights, and only for a limited part of the population. Now, the struggle was to expand those, but to larger parts of the population. Things like in 1996 was the World Food Summit in Rome, sponsored by the Food and Agriculture Organization of the United Nations. And in the final communique of that, which included a reference to the right of people to have food, the United States government said that, quote, any attainment of the, quote, right to food, end quote, or, quote, fundamental right to be free from hunger is a goal, an aspiration. In other words, the United States government wanted to go on record, and this was the Clinton administration, but it continues till today, to say that there is, from the point of view of the United States government, no right to food, that's only an aspiration. No right to housing, no right to health care, no right to those things that make life livable for people. So we have a very narrow presentation in the United States of what democracy means or what democratic rights mean. And still to today, the official position of the U.S. government is that those economic rights are not applicable.
Okay. Frank Emspach, I was listening to their Richard Becker and wondering which points in the U.S. that is not undemocratic, I should ask you. But I'm going to refer to the UN rapporteur who paid a visit recently to the U.S. And the one thing that stood out was what one of the things there that Richard Becker talked about, and that is the rights of Americans when it comes to voting, and especially when it comes to minorities like African Americans, and a slew of state laws restricting voting rights. What is going on there? And again, doesn't that put into question the notion of democracy?
What's going on here is an attempt by the Republican Party and the most authoritarian parts of it and those corporations that support it to find a way to maintain minority rule here, minority white rule, I might add, here in the United States, no matter what the vote is. And so all of these different maneuvers in the last 6 months or year since the Trump defeat in the Electoral College and the election in general are to limit the right to vote, to have the ability of state legislators to intervene, who might be Republicans, and overturn votes, to make it harder for people to vote, to make it a crime to give somebody water while they're standing online for 5 hours waiting to vote. And, you know, it fits in with a whole other thing. Why do we vote on Tuesday? It's a work day in this country. And most places do not allow people to go out of work to go vote. So you're talking about systemic methods in this country that have been under litigation fighting for years to limit the franchise, to find ways to make it more difficult to vote. And that is the situation. What's happening now is that you have, for the first time, I think, and certainly in my lifetime, and I think all of us, you have a group of people who are saying they're prepared to overthrow the government and try to and say that the elections are fake, the elections are not real, and call into question the very viability of this system. And that is different. That is different. And the attacks on the franchise now are part of that thinking. And that is a different kind of crisis that we have, and an attack on the basic notion of democracy, and very, very scary as a result.
Final question goes to you, Richard Becker, and we have to talk about this, and that is the U.S. wars, especially with the notion of regime change when it is the motivation behind it. We know that the U.S. has tried to do that, whether it's Iraq, whether we're talking about Syria, or with the Islamic Republic, trying to place their notion of democracy. And it's failed when it comes to Syria, for example. So many people to have been displaced, so many deaths. Doesn't that, again, put into question?
I mean, these wars.
Go ahead.
The undemocratic thing imaginable is the wars and the continue. Say you made a reference earlier to Israel and the Palestinians. The 2 million people in Gaza are locked into the biggest open-air prison in the world. In the West Bank, there are two different legal systems. The settlers are subject, the illegal settlers are subject to Israeli law. The Palestinians who live there are subject to emergency military regulations left over from British colonialism, and they're found guilty every single time, virtually, that they're charged. So, you know, so it's just the most utter hypocrisy to see Israel represented in this, this conference on democracy.
Thank you very much. We're going to end with Richard Becker, who's an anti-war activist from the Answer Coalition. Thank you for your comments from San Francisco. Frank Emsbach, thank you, political commentator who spoke to us from Madison. And with that, we come to an end for this edition of The Spotlight. Thanks for tuning in. Until next time, it's goodbye.
If you ask me, why do I stand here so unafraid of everything around me, proudly I would say, I am a Muslim. If you ask her, why does she dress that way, all covered up in a world that gives it all away, proudly she would say, I am a Muslim.
Islamic laws.
If you ask him, why does he still pray 5 times a day when so many others have strayed, smiling he would say, I am a Muslim.
Bismillah ar-Rahman ar-Rahim. In the name of God, welcome to the program Islamic Laws on RIB English Radio with me, Muhammad Javad, hosting this program. And sitting in the studio along with me, Sheikh Javid, well, the dear guest speaker in this program, Islamic Laws. Welcome to the program, Sheikh Javid.
Thank you very much. Thank you for having me.
The pleasure is ours. Stay tuned. We'll be back. Before we deal with the law of istihada and fluid discharge, which is the topic today and inshallah in the upcoming episodes, let's take a listen to a short biography of Ayatollah Sistani.
The Grand Ayatollah Sistani comes from the family of scholars and pious men. He learned theological and rational sciences from many eminent and well-known religious scholars. At the age of 5, His Eminence started learning the Holy Quran. He was then admitted in a religious center for reading, writing, and for learning basic mathematics and geography. In the beginning of 1360 Hijri, he started studying basic Hawza lessons. He also studied a number of books on philosophy like Sharh Manzuma-e-Sabzawari and Sharh Ishraq. Meanwhile, he attended Kharij lectures by the late Mirza Mehdi Ashtiani and the late Mirza Hashim Qazvini. In the late 1368 Hijri, he migrated to Qum to accomplish his studies in fiqh and usul. His Eminence left Qum for Najaf al-Ashraf. On having arrived in Najaf, he began attending Qayatullah Khoi and Sheikh Hussain Hilli's lectures in jurisprudence and the fundamentals of jurisprudence. In 1380 Hijri, Ayatollah Sistani traveled back to his hometown, the holy city of Mashhad, expecting to stay and settle down there. In the same year, he was awarded a permit by Imam Al-Khoi and another by Sheikh Hilli, certifying that he had attained the level of ijtihad, that is, deduction of legal judgment in matters of religion.
Let me start off this episode with this interesting question about a lady experiencing, in fact, two-day period of blood discharge while in the state of the menses or the menstruation period, all right?
Yeah.
And then suddenly she realizes that the blood discharge stops on the second day. Okay?
Yes.
And then should she consider this to be the menstrual blood? And how should she, in fact, go about it? Is she supposed to, like, perform ghusl or do something obligatory or offer anything?
You're right about it. Well, as you said, she sees the blood discharge and on the days when she's supposed to have her monthly period, but she ceased to see the blood on the second day.
Mm-hmm.
According to all religious authorities, as far as I know, of course, the period of menstruation or the time of menstruation, the time period, is not less than 3 days and not more than 2 days. If a woman discharges blood for 3 days, she has to consider herself as being in the state of haiz or monthly or menstruation. But if she discharges blood for less than 3 days, even by a measure of 1 hour, let's say, then she cannot consider herself as being in the state of menstruation. She should, of course, follow the rules of istihaza, okay?
Mm-hmm.
She should follow and act according to the rules of istihaza. And of course, as we said, depending on the type of istihaza, she has to either make one wudu for each prayer, which is the rule pertaining or relating to little istihaza,
mm-hmm.
or maybe she has to make one ghusl in the morning, or one ghusl for the five times prayer, and maybe she has to perform ghusl in the middle of the day because she discharges her bleeding started, let's say, after Fajr prayer. So in that case, she has to perform ghusl before the Dhuhr and Asr prayers. And of course, if the amount of blood is excessive and it stops on the second day, or so this is considered to be excessive istihaza, and of course she has to perform 3 ghusl for the excessive blood. But it is not considered to be haiz blood, of course, because mm-hmm. it is less than 3 days. And when a woman discharges blood for less than 3 days, then she cannot consider herself as a menstruating woman.
Yes, and not only that, but also I remember you talking about, in fact, the ladies usually being wise and aware of their menstrual period. You
sure.
know, they know, for example, for how many days it may last.
Yes.
All right?
Sure.
Sheikh Javid, let me ask you also this question. Is it obligatory for a woman to perform ghusl istihada
if she's fasting in month of Ramadan. I remember in one of the earlier episodes on the istihada, you talked about the little istihada, or this rule applies to all istihada types.
Of course, what I said in the earlier episode applies to also to excessive istihaza. A woman in the state of istihaza, whether it is excessive, whether it is medium or little, is not supposed to perform ghusl for the fast she is going to observe. Okay, if she is in the month of Ramadan, she is not supposed to observe fast for the. She is not supposed to perform ghusl for the fast of Ramadan. Mm-hmm. Of course, ghusl is obligatory upon her because of the prayers, and she has to perform ghusl for the prayers. As far as the fast is concerned, the fast is not affected, even if she does not observe, even if she does not perform ghusl.
Mm-hmm.
So ghusl is not a requirement for the fast to be valid.
I see. Okay, let's take a short break, and we'll be back discussing and continuing our discussion on this istihada with Sheikh Javed. Stay with us.
The Office of Ayatollah Sistani is currently providing the following services. 1. Board of Istifta, replying to religious questions. 2. Helping the poor, needy, homeless, and those who have suffered losses by earthquakes and floods. 3. Sending books for people who want to understand and learn Islam. 4. Hajj delegation. 5. Sending preachers. Board of Istifta is a link between Ayatollah Sistani and people. It provides them with answers to questions pertaining to religious, ideological, social, and educational matters in accordance with the verdicts and rulings of Ayatollah Sistani. For more information, visit the website of Ayatollah Sistani at www.sistani.org. You can also ask your questions through the following email, english@sistani.org.
Back to the program, Islamic Laws, on IRIB English Radio, with me, Muhammad Jawad, hosting, and Sheikh Javed, our guest speaker at the studio, talking about the topic of istihada. Well, Sheikh Javed, is it obligatory for a woman who's in the state of istihada, regardless of its type,
yes,
to prevent the flow of the blood if she has not offered her prayers?
Obviously, according to Ayatollah Sistani, it is necessary for a woman to stop the flow of blood, because she should not have blood on her body or on the part she is wearing while she has not performed her prayers, her obligatory prayers. So it is necessary to do everything necessary to prevent the flow of blood. And of course, she has to take quick action to perform her prayers. If she has just performed ghusl, she has to perform the prayers immediately after the ghusl. If she delays the prayer and she does not take a quick action, then she's required to perform another ghusl.
Mm-hmm.
That is a must. Of course, a woman cannot pray while she has blood on her body, or while she is stained with blood, or while she is najis, because blood is impure, and it does not make any difference whether it is the blood of haiz or istihada or nifas. And of course, these are the filthiest types of blood according to Islamic Sharia.
Mm-hmm.
Because the blood which comes out of a wound, or the blood which a woman which someone discharges, or the blood of a wound actually, is not as filthy as it is when a woman discharges it. Okay,
yes.
So that's the filthiest type of blood according to Islamic Sharia.
Yes. Having spoken about the different types of istihada,
And they're, in fact, obligatory rituals that we discuss together, is the ghusl for medium and excessive type of istihada, in fact, sufficient for wudu, Sheikh?
According to Ayatollah Sistani, the wudu for medium, wudu for medium istihada is not. The ghusl for medium istihaza is not sufficient for wudu, and therefore a woman should, as an obligatory precaution, because here Ayatollah Sistani exercises obligatory precaution,
mm-hmm.
and she's of the view, and he is of the view, let me correct myself, His Eminence is of the view that as an obligatory precaution, a woman should perform wudu after performing ghusl. So, medium ghusl is not sufficient for wudu. And of course, other religious authorities, as far as I know, they do not consider ghusl istihada sufficient, whether it is ghusl for excessive blood or medium blood or any other, or any one of these two. So, when it comes to excessive blood, of course, Ayatollah Sistani is of the view that the ghusl is sufficient for wudu, and it's not necessary to make wudu. Of course, it's not haram either to make wudu. So a woman is free to make wudu or not, but what is necessary for a woman is to perform her prayers very quickly after she takes the shower, okay, that obligatory shower.
Thank you very much, Sheikh Javid. That was the program Islamic Laws on RIB English Radio. Thank you very much for listening to us. Assalamu alaikum wa rahmatullahi wa barakatuh.
Journey, IRIB English Radio. Please log on to our website, www.parstoday.com/en.
Of Jalali, Tehran.
Rubashavit, Gaza.
Jerome Hughes, Brussels.
Saeed Puraza, London.
Russia, Zaglam, Istanbul.
Said Amin Olemi, Kabul.
Shahanabad, Indian administered Kashmir.
Around the world with reporters.
Inside the closed Sana'a International Airport, Yemen Civil Aviation Authority held a protest rally to mark World Civil Aviation Day. A number of state officials participated in the protest and slammed the continued closure of Sana'a Airport by the Saudi led coalition.
Today, we, like the rest of the world, celebrate the World Civil Aviation Day. This day means a lot for us as civil aviation workers, but unfortunately it comes as Yemen's airports are closed and being targeted in Saudi-led air raids. Sana'a Airport especially is being bombed in an unjustified way. The justifications made by the Saudi-led coalition that Sana'a Airport is being used for military purposes are incorrect. The United Nations is aware of the airport's activity and has daily flights through Sana'a Airport.
Protesters demanded the reopening of Sana'a Airport and called on the international community to pressure Saudi Arabia to lift its siege on Yemen. They held the UN responsible for not taking any action against Saudi violations.
Over 100,000 patients with chronic diseases have died due to the continued closure of Sana'a Airport, and there are about 400,000 more who are suffering from the shutdown. There are also 1 million patients who suffer from a lack of medicine that need refrigeration and must arrive through Sana'a Airport. The humanitarian situation is tragic and reflects the scale of the tragedy that Yemenis are experiencing due to the ongoing Saudi blockade.
6 years ago, Saudi Arabia imposed restrictions on Yemen's airspace and shut down Sana'a Airport. The closure has led to the death of tens of thousands of patients, including children, who needed to travel abroad for treatment unavailable in Yemen due to the collapse of the healthcare system. Thousands of Yemeni patients, including children, have died while waiting for a chance to travel through this closed airport, which is only receiving the United Nations flights. People here say the airport should also be closed to the UN to push the world body to take real measures against the Saudi blockade imposed on Yemen. Abdulatif Al-Washali, Sana'a.
The Russian leadership is extremely concerned about the possibility of large-scale hostilities in the eastern Ukraine, Donbas, and Crimea. There has not been such a level of military threat throughout Russia's modern history. NATO has dismissed Russia's proposal on zones of influence to somehow stabilize the situation. U.S. Secretary of State Antony Blinken has rejected a diplomatic dialogue, giving Ukraine carte blanche to withdraw from the Minsk agreements. The situation is more than ever close to a war. The United States has removed all diplomatic and political restrictions, while Ukraine's accession to the North Atlantic Alliance is a red line for Russia.
We are witnessing the expansionism of NATO led by the United States in the territories near Russian borders. That's why President Vladimir Putin is seeking legally binding security guarantees to prevent further destruction of the security system. If that does not work, our retaliatory measures will be harsh and the West will regret the missed opportunity for a deal with Russia.
Things appear to be heading toward a scenario of Russia's complete international isolation, in all-out technology and trade blockade, and an embargo on the purchase of oil and gas. To begin this plan, a military scenario might be implemented in Ukraine.
The NATO leadership understands that they have become weak and there is no unity in sight. They need threats to maintain funding, and they create them by portraying Russia as an aggressor. That's why we do not hear a single word of condemnation from the West against Ukraine's escalation of violence in the East.
The Kremlin understands that passivity only makes things worse. The responsibility for the conflict will remain with Russia, and no one will be interested in the real picture.
It is unpleasant to negotiate with NATO and the US, and talks with Ukraine will not resolve anything because it is completely subordinate to Washington. Russia needs to remember one thing: the Anglo-Saxon respect only force. Russia must continue to strengthen its security and combat capabilities given the unacceptable policies of NATO and the US.
Russia demands legal guarantees since the West has not kept its promise that after the reunification of Germany, NATO would not expand eastward. Further advancement of Western forces and provocations will affect the fundamental security interests of Russia.
If Moscow's legitimate concerns about Ukraine and NATO are not taken into account, Russia will take retaliatory measures to correct the military strategic balance. An alternative to these could be long-term security guarantees on its Western borders. Марина Картунова, Москва.
The coronavirus continues to provoke sharply different responses across Europe. There has been much concern over the new Omicron variant, but markets are surging on the bet that worries about Omicron have been as overblown as they were for the Delta variant. France has had perhaps the strictest coronavirus measures in the West, but the government surprisingly announced only a handful of new minor measures and no new lockdown. Corporate profits and economic inequality continue to surge unabated during the corona era, and incumbent politicians may be thinking about this spring's election.
French businesses are accumulating a lot of debt because business conditions are far from optimal. We're going to see a lot of bankruptcies all down the line because sales are not rising, even though costs are. We need a long-term logic, which is much more efficient, and even if we decide on even stricter sanitation controls.
The government also said schools will not be closed early for vacation, and they rejected a vaccination order for children, at least for now. France may have been swayed by a new report which found that during the first 15 months of the epidemic, not one healthy child between the ages of 5 to 18 died of COVID in Germany, Europe's largest country.
France's vaccination rate is now almost 80%. Prior to the pandemic, France was considered the most vaccine-skeptical nation in the world, but the introduction of a corona pass, which almost totally isolates the unvaccinated, has forced people into compliance.
Around Europe, lockdowns are back in Austria, despite massive protests. Germany is debating a vaccine mandate. Italy has moved to a new super health pass. And even though two-thirds of Europe is fully vaccinated, stricter measures may soon be arriving, regardless of the impact of Omicron. Perhaps the only certainty is that no government seems able to please all their citizens.
France's government has had a very poor strategy. For example, we provided free corona tests for a long time, but it was a major error because it cost us 6 billion euros. This money could have been used to create an actual screening strategy, which could have slowed the progression of the virus.
After 21 months of corona domination, what remains most unknown is when things will go back to normal. Europeans, especially non-vaccinated ones, are increasingly saying that time may be never. Rami Mazahari, Paris.
Figures have just emerged which show that less than 55% of the population in six EU nations have received a COVID-19 vaccine, despite plenty being available. Experts say vaccine hesitancy is the main reason behind rising coronavirus cases, hospitalizations, deaths, and the reintroduction of restrictive measures across the 27-country bloc. EU health ministers have been meeting in Brussels to take stock of the crisis.
So is this not a massive failure from the EU? Should the EU not be putting much more of its effort into trying to convince people to take the vaccines?
The EU citizens have moved forward, and we have over 66% of the total population vaccinated and 77% of the adult. But we mustn't stop.
Growing pressure on hospitals means that non-COVID patients are being neglected, and those without private health insurance are falling between the cracks.
Our member organisations are reporting on a daily basis of some of the barriers to access to healthcare, increasing co-payments, difficulties in accessing medicines, specialists, etc. This simply cannot go on.
As EU health ministers met on Tuesday, so too did the bloc's finance ministers. The message was both old and new risks to the EU economy are materialising.
Notably, the growing case
numbers and reintroduction of restrictions, global supply chains, and the rise of inflation.
Bulgaria and Romania stand out as having the lowest vaccination rates in the EU. Fears over new variants have been heightened by the Omicron mutation. At the start of the pandemic, EU nations closed their borders and turned their backs on Italy, which was buckling under the pressure. It was left to Russia to fly in emergency medical supplies. It's a story the bloc's leaders never talk about. In a veiled reference to it here, health ministers say there must be better cooperation between member states when the next crisis emerges. Jerome Hughes, Brussels.
It was a chaotic end to a 20-year-long U.S.-led occupation of Afghanistan. Thousands of Afghans who had worked with British forces appealed to be airlifted out of their country. Months after that shambolic evacuation, inflammatory claims about how the UK Foreign Office responded as the Taliban took over Kabul. 39 devastating pages of evidence provided by junior diplomat Rafael Marshall. Among the allegations, Marshall says up to 150,000 people applied for evacuation, but fewer than 5% got any assistance. No member of the team working on the evacuation requests had any knowledge of Afghanistan, and that Foreign Office staff stuck to the 8-hour shift culture during the emergency.
The truth of the matter is Afghanistan was a huge defeat for the Americans and for the British, and they didn't expect the government to fall so quickly. They didn't expect the Taliban to take control. The last thing they wanted to do was really bring attention to what went on there, and the evidence from this whistleblower makes that absolutely clear.
He reserves his most stinging criticism for former Foreign Secretary Dominic Raab, holidaying in Greece at the time, for dragging his feet on responding to the crisis.
We had a process in place to check two things.
The former Foreign Secretary has defended his decisions. And we all remember these images. Marshall claims Prime Minister Boris Johnson personally intervened to secure the evacuation of animals in the care of a British charity worker at the expense of Afghans at imminent risk.
Marshall claims also that an email he wrote to his superiors warning that people could die if things didn't improve was criticized for being shrill. That claim and the others mentioned in this report raise serious questions about the dysfunction at the heart of the British government with deadly consequences. Saeed Pourreza, London.
The World Bank spokesman has announced that donors to the Afghanistan Reconstruction Trust Fund have agreed to decide about the transfer of funds to humanitarian aid agencies by December 10th. In the meantime, people in Afghanistan complaining about the ongoing crisis in their country call on the donors to let the flow of aid and unfreeze the blocked assets.
I expect the donors to stick to their promises. What are they waiting for? We have lots of problems, including poverty and unemployment. Everyone will starve if no aid is sent to Afghanistan.
The world countries have always said that they are after helping us. The situation is worsening as the winter is around the corner. We hope that the World Bank donors help us get out of this disaster by sending humanitarian aid.
Economical experts say that however the aid would be helpful, but the international community, in cooperation with the Taliban, must seek other stable approaches for Afghanistan's economy, rather than relying on temporary programs.
The Taliban should show flexibility against the international community's request to gain trust so that the aid could be handed over to the new government in Afghanistan. The transfer of the frozen assets can be very fruitful amid the current poverty that the Afghans are struggling with.
This comes as the UN bodies and aid agencies are calling for more urgent assistance as winter bites. World Food Program says that it needs $2.6 billion to ramp up life-saving support to reach 24 million people in 2022. The U.S. has frozen nearly $10 billion in assets of Afghanistan as it tries to keep the Taliban away from accessing the money. The U.S. sanctions on the Taliban have led to a wave of hunger and poverty in Afghanistan, pushing a large portion of the people to the brink of a catastrophe. Afghans now hope that donor countries agree to extend a helping hand. Rahmatullah Baghban, Kabul.
France France's top NGOs and some unions rallied against the first presidential campaign stop of Eric Zemmour, a far-right journalist whose candidacy would have been unthinkable prior to the Islamophobia wave which has gripped France since the start of the great financial crisis. Zemmour is being called a Trumpian candidate for many reasons. He is not a part of any party. He has accused refugees of being thieves, killers, and rapists. He has been convicted of anti-Muslim speech and even wants to forbid giving babies Muslim names like Mohammed.
Zemmour is 100% racist. He should be kicked out of the race immediately based on the laws we have in place against racism. Zemmour profits from being a Jewish person in that he is being allowed to say things about race and religion which no one else would be allowed to say.
Zemmour thrives on outrage, but his popularity also stems from the fact that France's mainstream politicians have been totally discredited due to endless corruption scandals and kowtowing to the demands of Brussels and high finance.
The Yellow Vests oppose Zemmour and all fascists. We fight for the people and the rights which they are denied. Zemmour and Macron are the same dangerous sickness because they defend the rich class and also the same individuals. Both of them are just puppets who have the exact same puppet master.
It appears that the fight against Zemmour will serve as a safety valve because it's being presented in the mainstream media as a fight for progressive politics. However, even if Zemmour does not reach the second round, there appears to be essentially no chance that an even moderately progressive politician will take office in April. It's essentially a three-person race between Zemmour, the far-right's Marine Le Pen, who lost in 2017, and the incumbent Emmanuel Macron. Macron is on the far right economically and has also closed scores of mosques and forced the closure of the important NGO, the Collective Against French Islamophobia. The center and left is running behind the conservatives, making France's April election extremely right-wing and seemingly more right-wing every day. Rami Mazahari, Paris.
According to a study just published by the European Trade Union Confederation, wage inequality has grown in a majority of EU countries, 14 out of the 27 member states to be precise. The report was released to coincide with a meeting of EU employment ministers. They've agreed on a wage directive designed to protect those on low incomes.
The message coming today on the 6th of December from Brussels is a very positive, encouraging message, especially to those who are still in work poverty.
Millions of people in the EU are working in precarious jobs. Most of them are young adults.
A job well done requires adequate and just pay. This concerns the fundamental respect of people in their work. One of our priorities under the Slovenian presidency was high-quality job creation.
Although the new directive was passed here in the Council, Hungary and Denmark voted against it, while Germany and Austria abstained. Analysts say it's clear there will never be an EU-wide minimum wage. Pay systems and economies vary greatly. For example, currently, the minimum wage in Bulgaria is €312 a month. In Luxembourg, it is €2,142. Employers are afraid to invest at present due to all of the unknowns surrounding COVID-19, high energy prices and political uncertainty in some EU nations.
Businesses want certainty. They can't have certainty, but they would like a bit of predictability for investment reasons in particular. And they don't have that at the moment because of these issues that you just mentioned. And they don't know what's around the corner.
Disaster is around the corner for the EU project, experts warn, if the bloc's leaders continue in their failure to deliver greater social justice. Jerome Hughes, Brussels.
Thousands of Yemeni people have filled the streets and cities of Aden, Taiz and Mukalla in southern Yemen to protest against the government of former Saudi-backed President Abd Rabbo Mansour Hadi. Protesters condemned the widespread poverty and the deterioration of public services within areas controlled by the Saudi-backed government.
We hold the Saudi-led coalition fully responsible for what the situation has reached. the spread of poverty, and the decrease in the prices of the local currency. We are suffering to obtain flour and gas for our children.
We have a country that has oil and wealth, but unfortunately we are poor because of the corrupt government. They receive their money in dollars and Saudi riyals, and here salaries are worth nothing against foreign currencies and are not enough to provide